James chapter 3. We will be doing the next lesson in the series that I began at the beginning of the year in James 3. I wanted to tell you just a couple of things that happened lately that I was thinking about while we were worshiping a little bit ago. I think when the air conditioners aren't on, it's a lot quieter in here. And then when it's a lot quieter in here, I notice the kids more than I normally do. But I also sit in the front. I don't sit in the back. I just want to tell you a couple of experiences about children in church. Recently I was somewhere preaching, and they just don't have any. They don't have any children, no babies, no kids making noise. And so when I get back here and hear the kids, it makes me really happy. I appreciate the parents who wrestle with the kids and bring them, even though I know sometimes you don't always get to hear what's said and you don't get to participate. It's just such a valuable thing. And for those of us that I think have the right attitude, it's certainly not a distraction or a problem. It's a joy to us to hear them. But I will say, I recently preached at Inver Grove, and there's a young couple there that has a newborn, or a young toddler now, and she's a newer Christian, and she said, "Can you tell me what it is you guys do there at New Hope with the children?" She said, "Because every time I go there, all the children are perfect." And she said, "They like sit there and they don't make any noise." And I was like, "Well, I don't know what day you've been there, but like, I don't." But from her perspective, what all you all are doing was just an encouragement to her, and she wanted to know how to parent more like you. So thank you for that. I just love this church. I love all of you. And I really do appreciate you parents who do that with your children. For a moment, I want you to think about what we've been talking about this year. Some of you, this might be new if you're visiting, but we chose at the beginning of the year to do a series once a month on the wisdom from above versus the wisdom from below from James chapter 3. I want to remind you of a couple of things just by way of introduction. Look there at James 3:13. James says, "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds and the gentleness of wisdom." Remember, I pointed out that James has this habit in his letter of sort of asking, do you possess what God wants you to possess? Do you have faith? Do you have wisdom? But James isn't content for people to just say, "Yes, I have it." Back in chapter 2, he says, you may say that you have faith, but you need to show that faith by your works. Here, he asks the question, are you wise and understanding? Don't say yes, show it by your deeds. And that's a lot of what we're looking at. That wisdom is as wisdom does. That what we see as the fruit of our life really displays where we get our wisdom from. All of us are painfully aware of this, but there is a battle in each of our lives and in our time and in every time of humanity. Whether or not people are going to operate and live their lives by the wisdom of God or the wisdom of men. I think everything about our nature and some of our worst parts of ourself, they draw us toward the wisdom of man. Because of what it can accomplish for us. If you look there at verse 14. Verse 14 says, "But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, and demonic." I have a question. Well, why would anybody live like that? Why would they operate with the wisdom that is jealousy and selfish ambition? You know what the answer is? Because it makes them very successful in their life. There's a lot you can gain by envying people and being motivated by that envy to then be ambitious for yourself and go out and get what somebody else has. People have lived that way for a long time because they think it gains something for them. But the problem is, if you read the next verse, look at verse 16. "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing." You may get what you want in your family, in your workplace, in your community, in your nation, But as you're trying to get everything for yourself, and somebody else is trying to get everything for themselves, pretty soon you live in a world that's chaotic and not at peace, and there's difficulty. Some of you know that in your homes and in your workplace. God forbid that it be a part of the church. But we don't always see the bigger picture of where certain kinds of wisdom is going to lead in the long run. The wisdom from above is different. In the moment, it almost always costs us something. We almost always lose out on something. But the end result of living by the wisdom of God is future reward and peace that comes after a period of difficulty. James has a lot to say about that. And so what we've looked at the last few weeks, the last few months, have been the character of this wisdom from above. Let's notice there, starting in verse 17. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Go back to verse 17. The wisdom from above is first pure. This has a bearing on our lesson today. Today we're going to be talking about reasonable. The wisdom from above is reasonable. But the ones that precede it help us understand what this means. You see, living God's wisdom is about first and foremost making sure we know what is right and true. Even before seeking peace. Notice that peaceable is the second characteristic. The world gets that upside down. Sometimes in our efforts to want peace in our family, we ignore things that are going to be destructive because, after all, it's what you want to do. I need to let you live your life. And so in the name of peace, we let impurity go forward, and then it wrecks peace in the long run. The wise understand that sort of order of things. Now, as we begin to build on this, it's first pure, then it seeks to be peaceable. Part of being peaceable is that next word, gentle. And last month we talked a lot about mostly what does gentleness not look like. We looked at times in Scripture where those people that were described as not gentle had certain characteristics. And if we live like that, even though it may get us ahead or put us into powerful places, it's certainly not living the gentle wisdom of God. Let's talk about this next word. Look there at verse 17, and I want you to think about the next word in the list. The wisdom from above is reasonable, is what my version says. I want to show you something. This is interesting to me. I was studying this word and trying to figure out, like, okay, so what does it mean that the wisdom is reasonable? And you might already be saying, well, that's not even what my version says. Well, that's right. Watch this. There are so many different translations of this. The King James Version said, the wisdom from above is easy to be entreated. The New King James said, is willing to yield. The ESV says, it's open to reason. The Holman Christian Standard says, the wisdom from above is compliant. And then the NIV says, it's submissive. And I stopped with the translations because there's more. Isn't it strange that sometimes a word in the Bible can be translated by very smart people who interpret the language as a lot of different ways and nuances there? Well, part of the problem with this word is it's the only time it takes place is right here in the Bible. There's no other place to compare it. There's no place else to go and say, how did somebody else use it? This is the only time you'll see the word in the Greek in the Bible. And so there's a little bit of a wrestling match with the translators saying, okay, well, what exactly is James getting at? What does God want us to understand about wisdom being reasonable, willing to yield, easy to be entreated, compliant, submissive? You begin to take all those into account, and I think you begin to build a pretty good picture of a certain kind of person, don't you? Let me just ask you to look at the list for a minute. And I want to ask you, is this how people would describe you? Dad? Dad. I'll talk to Dad. As the father and the husband of your family, is what people would say about Dad is that he's just easy to entreat. He's very reasonable. And he's actually very willing to yield. when I have a request. How do you do with that? And I know what you're going to want to start doing is you're going to say, well, look, my job is not to yield on everything. My job is to not to know more than everybody else and not necessarily be open to reason because my reason's the better one because I'm dad, you know. So there's got to be a line here in how reasonable and willing to yield I am and still be a leader. All right, dads, I'm off you. Moms, how are you with this? Are you open to reason? Are you reasonable? Are you willing to yield, compliant, submissive? All right, kids, how do you guys do with this? When your parents try to give you instruction and say something, are you guys like open to that, easily talked to, compliant about that, and submissive? Does anybody recognize that this is a huge problem in relationships? Isn't this hard? How do they do in your workplace? How are the bosses? Does this describe them? And if you don't want to talk about the bosses because you're a boss, let's talk about the workers. Are the workers like this? This is actually, I think, one of the more difficult things about the wisdom from above is learning to be like this and understand what it means. So let me show you a little about the word itself, since it's the only time it takes place in the Greek. It is something like eupathos, or eupathos. I don't know how to say that. But it comes from two words. The first is eu, which means something like good or well. And the other one is pathos, which means to persuade, or to trust, or obey. It's translated, that word up there, that word is translated like 55 times in the Bible. But the only time that you have that in front of it is here in James. But when the word is translated, it usually is translated something like to persuade somebody. Either you were persuaded or you failed to persuade somebody. Or somebody was persuaded enough to trust and to obey. Now, the word here is you're good at it. You're good at being persuaded. You are, as some of the versions say, you're willing to yield because you're good at yielding. Let me show you where this gets a little tricky in the life of a Christian. I want to show you two times in the same chapter this word pytho is used. It's in Matthew 27. Just for a minute, look at Matthew 27. And I want you to think about being in this scene and what would have been complicated about this. Matthew chapter 27. The first time you'll see it in this text, and by the way, this is the first time in the New Testament that this word is used. The first time the word persuaded is used in the New Testament is Matthew 27:20. And here it says, the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death. You see that? They persuaded the crowds. Now, time out. Were the crowds easy to be persuaded? Were they yielding to the wish of the elders and chief priests? And the answer would be, yeah, they were. Was that a good idea? Should they have been willing to yield? And quick and open to their reason of these scribes and Pharisees? Well, they were persuaded. That's the word. Look at verse 27 now. Verse 43. I'm all off here. Verse 43. Let's start reading in verse 42. They said to Jesus on the cross, he saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe him. He trusts in God, let God rescue him now, if he delights in him, for he said, I am the Son of God. You see in verse 43 there, the word trust. Same word. Jesus was persuaded to trust God. The people were persuaded to trust their elders. Now both of those things can't be the right persuasion. But I wonder, were both of Jesus and the crowds, could they be described as good at trusting or willing to yield? The answer would be yes, they were. The difference is Jesus was quick to yield to God, and these people were quick to yield to something that they shouldn't have yielded to. This becomes actually the complication of this teaching. When God says to us, the wisdom from above is willing to yield, does he mean just to me? Obviously, that would be the first way to apply it. We need to be quick to yield to God. That we need to be easily entreated and submit to him, willing to yield, open to reason. When God says do this, we do it. And that's our attitude towards God. But I'm going to suggest to you that James isn't actually talking about that here. He actually, I believe, is saying this is how we need to be with other people. Willing to yield. Now, there will be a line that we can't cross. But generally speaking, in our interactions with people, part of the wisdom of God teaches you don't have to be first every time. You don't have to win every argument. You don't have to have the last piece of cake. You don't always have to be the one to promote yourself and get what you want. Part of what will make you live the wisdom of God is your willingness to put others ahead of you. I really believe that's the teaching here. Let me show you what this looks like in real life. Go back to the Old Testament with me to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1. I personally think this to be one of the greatest real life examples of what would have been a very difficult sort of tightrope to walk, a difficult thing to navigate for young people in the book of Daniel. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his buddies, they were young men. Now, they lived originally, before they were taken to Babylon, in Jerusalem. Now, it would have been very hard for a Jew who was being attacked by Babylonians to surrender. The pride of being the people of God, sort of the thinking that you could fight back and that God would deliver you, that would have been a very prevailing attitude in Jerusalem. In fact, if you read the book of Jeremiah, false prophets were basically saying that. False prophets were saying, you're God's people, it's never going to happen, you can fight back. And you had one prophet named Jeremiah who was saying, actually, here's what God wants you to do. When the Babylonians come, yield, submit, put your hands up, walk out to them and say, take us with you. And if you do that, you'll be spared. Now, that would have been complicated for a young person, right? With all their zeal, with all their national pride, with understanding who they were and feeling the way they felt about the Babylonians, I want you to think about Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah being willing to submit to this foreign government who was attacking their nation. And then they get to Babylon. In the chapter that we're in here in chapter 1, you see their interactions with the Babylonians. Do you remember that? They were good boys who did their work when they were in school for the Babylonians. But there were some things that they couldn't do. There were lines that they wouldn't cross. The king wanted to feed them with all kinds of food that the Babylonians ate, but these guys had certain convictions about what they would do and what they wouldn't do. Totally willing to submit in ways that they could. But when it came to eating certain food, they drew a line and they said, we don't want to eat that. And they even, in their interaction with the leaders in chapter 1, if you read that sometime, it's fascinating the attitude they had towards these leaders, the way they reasoned with them. Well, would you agree, if you know the story, that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were submissive, wonderful employees of the state who did what the kings wanted. And whenever the king said, do this, they did it. Until chapter 3. Look at chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar had built this big image, and we don't know much about it except that it was a tall image that he wanted everybody to gather around and bow down and worship. So when he made the decree that everybody had to worship, three boys didn't bow down. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They didn't bow. They would not submit or yield to the king's request on this occasion. Now, when the king finds out that some people hadn't bowed, he's furious. Look at verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will be immediately cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Now, I'll tell you something about these guys. If I was one of them, I might have looked at the crowds that were bowing, and I might have thought something like this. Okay, well, I'm not going to bow, and nobody will probably notice, because there's so many people here, maybe they just won't notice. Well, somebody noticed, and then somebody reported me. And then I got to take that long walk up to the raging King Nebuchadnezzar, who was the god of the world at the time, and he could do anything he wanted to me. And even though he's angry, he looks at me and maybe recognizes me as one of the kids who'd always been compliant. Which is why it may explain why he's raging in the one verse, and in the next verse he gives him a second chance. And he gives him a second chance. I'll tell you, if I was one of them, I would have thought, it was easier to not do the first time, but now there's a fire I can feel, and everybody's looking at me. And I know what's going to happen if I don't submit. Look at their response to the king in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up." Let me ask you a question about these guys. Would they rightly be described as willing to yield? Were they reasonable? Were they open to reason? Did they have the character of the wisdom from above in this matter? And my answer is a resounding yes. But they had their priorities straight. They understood that that applied first and foremost to God, always willing to yield to Him. He was the one that was their king. But they also had wisdom enough to see that beneath God were other leaders and rulers and people in authorities. And if their instruction didn't contradict something that God had said, and that there was an ability for them to go ahead and surrender and be captive and work within the regime that was this, terrible regime, they would go ahead and do it up until the line where they were asked to cross. And they wouldn't go any further. Now, Daniel's not part of this story, but you guys remember in chapter 6, the same thing happens to Daniel with the Persians, the lion's den. The king makes a decree not to pray, and Daniel, even though he's an old man, he just won't budge. And he's always been such a good worker for the king that when the king finds out that Daniel's the one who violated the law, he loses his mind over it. Because this guy had always been such a good worker, been so compliant, but now he won't comply. You know, there's a lot, I think, to work through with this as we begin to look at what our life would be with this. I want to show you a couple things the Proverbs says about this idea. Turn with me to Proverbs 25. Proverbs 25. Of course, this is the wisdom literature, so it makes sense that we're going to see some things taught in the wisdom literature about this. I want to show you what almost sounds like contrasting ideas. And of course, there's tension in this discussion, and the truth is somewhere in the tension of this. But look at verse 26. 25:26 of Proverbs says, "Like a trampled spring and a polluted well is a righteous man who yields before the wicked," or who gives way before the wicked. Now that's all the proverb says. A righteous person who yields before the wicked. And of course, the implication of this would be you yield to their influence, or you yield to their behavior, or you participate in what they're trying to get you to participate in that you shouldn't be participating in. When you do that, you're like, did you catch the imagery? Like a trampled spring. You ever gone camping? We're going to go camping soon in the Boundary Waters, some of us. And we'll get water out of the lake. And we'll hang it in a bag and it'll drip down and it'll filter and we'll drink that without hoping not to get sick. But I'll tell you what has happened before when I've gone to get water out of the lake. I step into the lake, and when I step into the lake, the mud like all gets stirred up, and then I gotta like find a new location to get the water because I've trampled the spring. Your life's kind of like that. If you yield to wicked people and you do what's ungodly. That's one side of the coin. Go back earlier in chapter 25 and look at verse 6. Verse 6 of chapter 25 says, "Do not claim honor in the presence of the king, and do not stand in the place of great men. For it is better that it be said to you, 'Come up here,' than for you to be placed lower in the presence of the prince whom your eyes have seen." Now notice the wisdom of this. Don't self-promote. Don't be selfishly ambitious and come up and say, "Hey, I'm going to be important here." He says, don't do that. You hang back and let somebody invite you to come higher. Well, it says those things about that relationship with leadership. Now look at the next verse. Verse 8 says, "Do not go out hastily to argue your case. Otherwise, what will you do in the end when your neighbor humiliates you? Argue your case with your neighbor and do not reveal the secret of another, or he who hears it will reproach you and the evil report about you will not pass away." Right after it talks about relationship with leadership, it also then says, be careful about arguing. Now follow this. Go with me to Proverbs 17:14. This proverb says, "The beginning of strife is like letting out water, so abandon the quarrel before it breaks out." Now the imagery of this is like a dam. Somebody's built a dam and there's water behind it, and the beginning of an argument is like a trickle that begins to come out of a crack in the dam. And if you keep poking at that thing, and you keep messing around with that crack, it won't be very long before the dam breaks and the whole torrent of water is going to overwhelm you. And the proverb says, arguing is kind of like that. So what's the advice? All right, here's what wise people do. You ready? Wise people win the argument. No, they don't. Wise people see that something's going on like this, and they're willing to yield. They're willing to just let somebody else talk. They don't have to win the argument. By the way, would this help any of your marriages, by the way? Would this help you in your workplace? To get to a place where you understood that you didn't have to win the argument every time. That sometimes you just could back off and be reasonable about it. And you might say, well, they're being unreasonable. Yes, but the wisdom of God says, you just back off. Look at chapter 20 now. Proverbs 20, verse 2. "The terror of a king is like the growling of a lion. He who provokes him to anger forfeits his own life." Now, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they kind of understood that verse, right? Kings are powerful. People in powerful positions are powerful. Your boss could fire you. You know, your loved ones could make you miserable. People have all these different positions in life, and depending on where you are in this, you can either throw a fit and cause trouble and end up messing things up for yourself. Or you can look at the next verse. Verse 3 says, "Keeping away from strife is an honor for a man, but any fool will quarrel." Did you catch that? Could I tell you how long I've lived my life and not really believe that verse? You know what I used to believe? It was an honor for a man to win an argument. Because I was right. Everybody look at me, I was right. This verse says, it's actually an honor for a man to not quarrel. Anybody can do that. You can fight about anything. Stop it. Cut it out. That's not the wisdom of God. Until the day comes where you have to draw a line in the sand and say, here but no further, I can back up, but I can't go any further and not fall off God's cliff. But I'm going to have to trust God and obey God rather than men. But when it comes to anything short of that, the wisdom of God says, submit. Let me end with this passage of Scripture that I just want you to consider as we finish. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter 2. I'm not a fighter. I never have been. Part of that was just good sense. I knew when I was a kid that if I got in a fight with somebody, I was going to lose that fight. I was scrawny. My best fighting was with my mouth and my very fast legs. And I won a lot of fights that way. But it didn't ever make me look like much of a fighter. It made me look a little bit more like a coward. When I got a little bit older, my dad decided to put me into Taekwondo. And so I went to this Taekwondo class, and we began to learn some things. And what I learned was that I couldn't stretch like some of those kids could stretch. I hurt myself a lot of times at that. But they taught a technique in fighting. Have you ever heard about this technique? That sometimes the best kind of fighting is not aggression. It's not coming at somebody and being aggressive. That there is a form of fighting which is actually submitting to the power of another. It's like when somebody comes at you strong with their momentum, you could either come at them and try to meet them with force in all of your arrogance and pride, or you could take their momentum and throw them with their sort of strength. But that causes you to retreat and back up, and it's sort of like this submissive way of winning a war. In fact, many wars, if you know history, have been fought that way by somebody who is brilliant. It could think about things in terms of, we're going to go ahead and let them be aggressive to come through here, and then perhaps we'll flank them. Or somehow we'll win this by being meek, not strong. Did Jesus teach lessons like this? The meek will inherit the earth. When your enemy strikes you on the one cheek, turn to him the other also. If somebody persecutes you, pray for them. If they want to sue you and take away your cloak, give them your shirt, give them your cloak also. Go with them an extra mile. Be submissive. Be submissive. You be willing to yield. You let others take away your rights with a good attitude. Why? Look here at 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. Verse 13 starts this way. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Now look at verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect. Now look at chapter 3, verse 1. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behaviors of their wives. Now look at verse 7. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. Four times in this section, Peter is going to talk to different people, citizens, slaves, or employees, husbands and wives. And the instructions he will give are the same every time. Submit. Now the question I have is, do you mean, Peter, that if the government wants me to do evil, I do evil? He says, no, that's not what I mean. In fact, you read it closely. He says, I want you to be willing to suffer for doing what's right, not for doing what's wrong. Chapter 1, he's going to say, be holy like God is holy. That's the first order of business. Second, in everything else in your life, you don't have to win. You can be willing to yield. You can let some things go if it's not essential. Look how he sums it up in verse 8 of chapter 3. To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. Not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. That's the wisdom of God. Are you aware how powerful this wisdom is? I mean, it's hard for Christians to wrap their mind around that if we ever do indeed live under a regime or a government that's hostile toward us, they take away rights, they make things very difficult because of our stand for who we believe in and what we believe is right, that if instead of fighting and arguing and causing all kinds of ruckus, we just submit to the punishment. Do you know how powerful that could be? If you ever question it, go back to chapter 2 and read verse 21 through 25, and I'll leave you with this. What I'm about to read in 1 Peter 2, 21 through 25 is the day that God submitted to us. Did you catch that? This is the day that God submitted to us. He was willing to yield. For even called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed, for you were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. Why didn't Jesus submit to human beings putting them on a cross? That's not right, Jesus. That's sin. Don't submit to our sin, Jesus. But here's the key to it. You know what Jesus wouldn't do? He wouldn't sin. No sin was found in him. No deceit was found in his mouth. Even though they were sinning, he wouldn't stoop to the place of sinning back. But when he submitted to those around him that were mistreating him with their sin, while himself maintaining his integrity, what did he accomplish? Honestly, what did he accomplish? He saved the world. Why? Why? Jesus said one time, if I am lifted up from the earth, talking about the cross, I will draw all men to myself. Remember that? Look at the end of what we just read in verse 25. You were continually straying like sheep, but now you've returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. Sometimes in the Bible, he's a shepherd going out looking for lost sheep. But here, the shepherd suffers to draw the sheep who are wandering back. It's like, instead of going out and wounding the sheep to get them to come, he allows himself to be wounded, and the compassion and the awe of that gets us lost ones to come back to what is a demonstration of something we've never seen in the world. The wisdom of God. Do you see the power of it in your own life? You want to win your spouse? You want to win your co-workers? Christians, you ready to rise up in the face of what looks like's coming in our society with the governments and all of that? You ready for this? Keep quiet. Mind your own business. Work hard. Be right. Do right. Live with hope. And see what God will do with it. I do, that the people in the world that are looking for something will finally see it in you. And they'll say, you're different than even other Christians that I've seen who are hollering and yelling and screaming about their rights. And I'm intrigued by the peace that you have and the harmony that you live in. And I want what you have. And then we get to teach them about the wisdom of God and the Christ who is our wisdom. Thank you for your attention. If you've not submitted to God yet, let me ask you, Why not? Are you maybe not somebody who is reasonable? You're not quick to yield. You're not easily entreated. What more could God do to prove to you that He wants you to obey Him than all the ways He's demonstrated His love? If you haven't submitted, think about doing that today. Thank you for being here. Let's go ahead and stand and sing together. If you have needs, let us know how we can help you.